So yeah, we wanted to invest in some mics because audio is important, and this is a podcast. And as much as we like videos, I mean, we make videos, but like,
yeah, we want to be known for quality.
Yeah, and I was just, well, really, the answer is I was walking home, and I would listen to our podcast sometimes, switch it over for my other podcast, and it was like, that doesn't sound like a podcast. That sounds like two people talking in an echoey room in a WeWork. So, yeah, now we're at the threshold level.
Nice.
Now, once we get our code up to that threshold level, then we'll really be legit in the minds of everyone.
Keep dreaming.
So, yeah, it's been a while since we podcasted.
Yeah. Let's talk about what we put up on the site recently.
What did we put up on the site?
I did a video on keyboard navigation.
You weren't centered over it.
It's going to take me a minute.
Yeah.
I did a video on keyboard navigation. It's like a declarative API, so you can write just a bunch of template code to navigate with a keyboard, like through a page. So like, you know, in Gmail, you can hit like J and K to like select the next and previous emails in your inbox. I did that sort of thing with a data table, and the Ember API that we end up with is super sweet. Nice. Just like two lines of template code.
What was the motivation you were working on?
I was working on an app where I needed this. I needed to like cycle through, I had a modal open and I need to cycle
through. Fast boot cache stuff.
Yeah, the fast boot cache. So I needed to like view the next modal. So I need to like cycle the, you know, you have like a list of models, a list of cache entries. You're viewing them in a modal, and I just wanted to hit the arrow keys to go through that modal and show the next and the previous and so on.
Right.
And I realized as I was building this that every app we build has this component, this like declarative keyboard component.
Right.
I think previously we had an autocomplete search, and the idea was you could, once you start typing, you could use the arrows to select the next and the previous entries.
I see.
And then, but still want to be able to type to like filter. And yeah, this search thing had like a whole bunch of requirements. But yeah, that app used this as well. And I realized like, wow, I just keep reinventing this component.
Yeah.
And like the nuts and bolts of it are always the same.
Right.
And so, yeah, I thought it would be a good video.
That's awesome. Yeah. There was, it was a great video. It was funny because I was just working on the second email. We're working on this email course. And the second email is about, it's kind of like wrapping up declarative rendering. The idea is there, and it's an application of this basically. And it's saying, if you can, thinking about how to share some piece of functionality within a component, it's a new way to think about it. It's not normally how you would reach for it. Like, I need to run some code on a scroll event, but like rendering a component can do that.
Yeah.
You know? So this one was like scrolled into view. So like when you get something into view and you need to do something, you can do that in a component, and like you can wire up a keyboard event in a component. And it's just like, it's weird to think about that.
So this email you're writing, it's like you scroll into view and you load more, something
yes.
like that. I remember the first time I saw this like a couple of years ago,
yes.
and it blew my mind.
It's,
like I was like, wait,
remarkable.
This actually works.
Yeah.
And like, there's no on scroll. There's
right.
no like.
Because
there's
the
no
thing.
Calculating heights or offsets. Yeah, it's
right. It's a thing. It's like, it's great when you have a 15 lines of code that you copy and paste and you paste it in and it works. But when you have like a component that's like one line and it makes it, it's just awesome.
It's, you know, it's like getting out of context. So when I'm writing code and I want to do like some on scroll or some keyboard navigation, if I know that I have a component that I can just render
right.
to do this,
right.
that's so much easier. Even if it's only 15 lines of code that I can like grab from Stack Overflow.
Right.
It's still like, okay, got to like context switch, go find something
totally.
That works.
And I really like, you know, in your video, you were saying one of the things you said, or maybe even in the summary, you were just like, this is the kind of thing that often gets, it's just, it's on the margin, like that gets ignored, or is just like, we don't quite have time for that. But if you can do those kinds of things and make it as easy as rendering a p tag in HTML, then like you're never going to not do those things.
Totally. Like totally. It always gets dropped. And yeah, you never think about it. The only reason you ever add keyboard navigation is because someone says like, oh, I really want a keyboard navigation.
Right.
And I mean, I guess that's like there's a good side of that, you know, you're waiting to build the feature until there's actually a need for it.
Right.
But yeah, there's so many times like, yeah, cycling through modals, cycling through drop downs.
So that makes me think of other things that are in that category. And first comes to mind is like animation. Like animation just gets dropped behind because it's like, what am I even going to do? But if it was, when it's as easy as changing from if to liquid if, you do it.
Yep.
You know, liquid if has some issues. There's a promise that the new primitives from Ember Animated are going to like replace a lot of that. But what if, you know, you're building a sortable list and making it animated is as easy as installing an add-on, changing it to like liquid each.
Yeah.
Right. So like, that's the kind of stuff that's, I find super exciting, because when we talk about what Ember enables us to do and what we actually get to do in the apps that we build, like a lot of times there's a gap there.
Yeah. Right. We talk about like the theory that you can do things in single page applications,
right,
but then like when the rubber hits the road, right, you end up with something that might look a little more like a CRUD app.
Right.
And yeah, definitely the way we shorten that gap is, you know, it's simple important. APIs.
Right. And simple. Right. Exactly. Right. Brain dead simple APIs. It's great. Not having to call remove event listener, not having to call add event listener. I mean, it's verbose and annoying.
It's not having to call remove event listener. It's not having to deal with the fallout from when you forget to call remove event listener.
Exactly.
Because you will.
That's the pain. Maybe we should just like get a list of all the DOM APIs
and make components
for every one of them. Because like in the email we talk about that, and it's like you realize, what does Ember really cover? It covers like inner HTML when like rendering a variable. It covers like add and remove event listener with an action handler, basically. Or maybe that's not even the action handler, but that's like actually I wonder what that is.
What do you mean?
Like if you do anchor tag action.
Yep.
And then like, you know, click. I know the action handler will grab the function off the actions hash, bind it to the context, so it'll take care of that. But like, who's calling add event listener?
I think in Ember there's like a global listener.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. I think there's a global listener, but still, like, that's just stuff like in the backbone days you had to wire up,
right?
Especially with you know, like if blocks and things change,
right?
Like, there's just so much. So it's easy to do, and there's so many mistakes that you can make,
right? So like, yeah, add and remove event listener, inner HTML, and then what was the other one? Like conditionals and like each, like control flow.
And inner HTML, I mean, inner HTML is huge. It's the data binding.
Yeah.
Right.
Re-rendering.
Change something and everything updates.
Right.
It's pretty amazing.
It's super amazing. But like, it's just cool that you don't ever have to call those APIs anymore. But then I was thinking about, what other APIs can we wrap in components we never have to call, like on scroll for the scrolled into view thing. That's one.
Resize.
Yeah. Window resizer. Yep. Exactly. Using the like with screen or whatever. You know, if we had like a video play, you know, a declarative video component that is a version of the HTML video component with all the events that are easy, you know, did stop or whatever like that. So, and then you just never have to deal with those things ever again.
Yeah.
Request animation frame. I don't know.
And you really want, I think the dream is that over the years, there's a bunch of like jQuery plugins that were written before all this, before React, Ember, all these frameworks existed. I think you want those things, those jQuery plugins, to start to turn into components. You know, I know we talked in a previous episode that when you like run straight for a component for those, it's you lose the escape hatches.
Right.
But I think the ideal state is you end up with a component.
Totally.
It's going to take a while to get there.
I know. It frustrates me that it takes a while to get there, because I like to think in terms of, especially with like this UI component stuff that we're working on, it's like I want everything to just be abstracted away so that it's like this nice thing. But then you look at someone building a new part of the site or whatever, and it's like you wouldn't know ahead of time. So it's nice having... There's a level of abstraction that's nice, that's built, still building blocks. It's like Legos, but like you're a little bit higher than just, you know, the raw bricks or whatever.
Yeah. I just thought of one. Data fetching.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Data fetching.
Yeah. It's true. It's a ton of boilerplate, ton of wiring.
Yeah.
You have to know the implementation details of like a fetch library or the format.
I mean, just think about how often in the next 3 months you will see code that calls window.fetch.
Right.
And
right.
You know. There is a world where we don't ever see that. It's hard to imagine,
but
it's only template code that fetches data.
Yep. When are we going to talk about all this fast boot stuff you've been working on? Is that later.
I've been shipping it. So it's not like, it's not just hidden in some PR somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm shipping it.
So real users are getting real bugs from our app right now because of this code that you've been shipping.
Absolutely. I've still, you know, it's hard for me, right? Because I am shipping stuff. People are using it. But then, like, I have this end vision that's, you know, months away where, like, you have some server that you spin up and it automatically can pre-warm all your Fastboot cache and figure out what to serve to what users. And, you know, there's, like, a million features that I want to add.
One of the things we were talking about this week that you were working on was this idea that, you know, we had talked about this before where Fastboot is... It is just install Fastboot for the 50%, but then the problem is like you don't want to rely on Fastboot generating a response at runtime, basically ever.
You
need a cache.
50% is a good way to put it. Like Ember install, Ember CLI, Fastboot is great for developing an app that's going to work with Fastboot, but now you need some way to run that in production
to serve it. Yeah,
and you can't. I mean, you can run Fastboot in production, but you shouldn't. Right. And most people that are running sites on Fastboot will tell you that you Fastboot should not be a runtime dependency.
Right.
So the idea is that you have to get a cache.
Right.
And serve from the cache.
Right.
And then, you know, now it's...
You're dealing with an easy problem.
Right.
Caching is easy. So we've been talking about how to, like, declare all the dependencies for pages and which responses they need to work and how to generate those ahead of time and store them in a cache and node and serve them from Redis, basically. And that's kind of what you've been working on. And then, you know, we had this idea that, like, oh, the first page can be, like, one person gets a runtime generated page, it's fine. But, like, then it's in the cache and then it'll be fast, like the homepage, let's say.
Right. And that's like, as of this podcast, that's the current architecture.
That's the current architecture.
So the cache isn't... It's like a cold cache. Mm-hmm. First request comes in. You know, it might take a second to get a response.
Might take 30 seconds to get a response. I mean, Node might crash and you might get half of an HTML string.
Nah, I thought Node was fast.
But then we were just talking about, we had this idea this week where, you know, if you think about what are the best ways to get a response from a site, and this basically is true for any site, right? I mean, a warm cache is a cache hit is ideal.
Yep.
And then if you, in our case, if you don't have a cache hit, you have a cache miss, would you rather, there's two branches of that decision tree, which one is the client app and one is Fastboot warming the cache, giving you the response, which will be used.
Fastboot running at runtime.
Right.
Like runtime Fastboot.
Right. Yeah. And in that case, you'd actually rather, if it's a person who clicked a link to your site, you'd actually rather just give them the Ember app probably because they're already running the Ember app in Fastboot, but now
it's going to be faster for them to download the JavaScript and no HTML and then boot the Ember app on like client side and have that render rather than having your
app,
you know,
server,
your AWS server
rendering
it. It's just not going to be as fast.
Right. Not as much memory. Yeah. All that stuff. So then
there's, you know, there's a thing here. I think it's called like in HTTP server caching, it's like avoiding a stampede. And this is very similar to this problem. Mm-hmm. So like imagine we're talking about like a cold cache and a request comes in and it's like, okay, do I just serve a non-Fastboot app or do I serve the client-side app? Client-side app is what I call like a non-Fastboot app.
Mm-hmm.
Do I serve like the client-side app or do I let Fastboot run and serve that response? There's also like a chance that like a cache entry expires. And so now a request comes into the server and like, there's just like some cache entry expires in let's say like 3 hours and you're kind of left with the same decision. Like, do I serve the old cache entry or do I like run all the code and generate a response and serve a new entry? And there's like, this thing is called avoiding the stampede, which is this idea that, well, the cache entry is expired, but you still serve the old cache entry.
Mm.
And then once that response is sent, whatever worker, whatever served that response goes off and replaces it.
Behind the scenes.
Behind after the scenes. Fact. So this is the same idea. We're just doing this with a cold cache.
Oh, cool. And the thing is that that person could get a stale, is technically they're getting a stale cash entry, but the idea is it's better for them to get the most recently stale entry.
A fast stale response rather than a slow current response. And this is something, this is like a trade-off you can make.
Right.
And the reason they call it like avoiding the stampede is because like imagine a cash entry expires and you have like a popular site like GitHub or something.
Right.
And now all of a sudden there's like five people or 500 people requesting the same page at once. Like there's nothing in the cache.
You have to build queuing or something in order for them not to all trigger cold rebuilds or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the worst case scenario is all 500 workers start building the page.
The same page.
And then clobbering themselves as they write it to the cache.
Yep. Especially if it's popular. Okay.
So that's this idea is that one worker like goes off and, you know, there's tons of optimizations here, right? Like locking mechanism where one thing locks it, generates it, everything else waits for it.
Right. But at that point, yeah, there's that, you can make that trade-off and it might be better to just give them the thing that was like a second old, but it's not like crucially out of date or something.
So with us, it's kind of the same idea. We're saying we're going to give you the non fast boot thing and then go generate that.
Right. Right. So the idea is you make a request, cache is cold, and we just give you the client app, and then asynchronously you have Node warm the cache.
Yep. Generate that cache entry.
And that's cool because that solves the problem of the cold, the cache miss, but it also works like we were talking about building up a list of URLs. And if any of the dependencies for those pages change, like rewarming the cache for that, and that works, that's great. But then we were trying to think about, you know, we want to think about if this architecture works for every kind of app. We're thinking about GitHub, and GitHub, you have like a million URLs.
Well, dynamic content,
right?
So with Embermap, we can actually deploy something in production with a fully warm cache because we know all of our URLs. Right.
Let's say we have 100 pages or something on the site.
I mean, and even if we had like 1,000,
right?
Like,
right,
we can generate all those.
Yep. Or we've talked about like TED, which has like 2,000 talks, let's say, and it's like you could just build it. You could almost build it as a static site, right? Whereas something like GitHub, it's inconceivable to build as a static site. So the question is like, and we talked about this before, caching makes more sense the bigger the buckets. You know, if you have the one page that's the same for everybody, it makes sense. For accounting software like YNAB, you know, caching, you want the site to be fast, but the content gets stale quickly. So it's not as important.
The content gets stale and like your cache size, if you have a new cache entry for every user because it's accounting software.
Right.
Like it's hard to manage that.
Yeah. It just doesn't make as much sense. It's also just not as important because the whole idea of like caching things that are popular, that are being shared, that lots of people are viewing, whereas like you open up your personal app and it's like, yeah.
Yep.
So, but this kind of solves that problem where you don't need to necessarily go through a list of known URLs and like have a worker warm everything for the whole site. If you have a dynamic site like this, but let's say I do change something in my GitHub repository and it's dynamic. And so I fetch it and I get the dynamically generated client side rendered page and then the cache gets warmed. But now if I never change anything, I come back, I can get a cache hit.
Yep.
For that, which is awesome. And on the server side, we didn't have to like do anything for that.
Yeah.
It's just like a generic solution.
Yeah. And the worst case scenario here is a first user gets a client app.
Right.
So it's a little slow, but it's not.
I mean, there's plenty of apps that are like that anyways. Yep. So, it's pretty awesome.
And if something is trending on like Twitter,
right,
that's all going to be shared.
Right.
So it's not, you know, those are... That's when you want like the fast site, right?
Right?
Like when someone clicks the link from Twitter, they don't see a white screen for a second.
Right, exactly.
So
it's pretty cool. I'm pretty happy with the ideas of the architecture and like just the idea. To me, it feels very within reach to be able to just have this and like ship the Ember app and you turn this on and now you have like a great Lighthouse score. And you're not really doing much. You're not having to think about this much on your own.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. You want to hear like some of my like crazy mad scientist ideas that are far off for
of
this?
Of course.
So when you're serving pages from a cache, there's like a ton of, you just have an HTML string. And there's some optimizations you can do to make the page even faster given an HTML string.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them is we know the CSS files because we know the CSS files because when we build the Ember app, we're left with, you know, two CSS files, mm-hmm. app.css and vendor.css. Mm-hmm. And we have an HTML string that we're serving to the users.
Mm.
So now we can inline all of the...
Oh, interesting.
All the CSS. And so you can think of this in the same... kind of the same architecture you just described, where the first person that visits the site, there's nothing in the cache, so they get the client app. The second person that visits the site, well, now there's like a fastboot rendered page in the app, so they get the fastboot rendered page. And after that's served, like in the background, you take that CSS and that fastboot page and you inline all the CSS.
Oh, wow.
So then the third user that visits the site, they get an inline CSS HTML string. So now their site is even going to load. Their site is going to load even faster.
Couldn't you do that as part of, at the end?
Sure, okay. Sure. The end of step one. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Basically, you're saying if you have, give me an HTML, give me a massive CSS file and an HTML template, and I can just pick out the rules that are being used and just throw them in head. Copy them and just throw them in head.
Yeah. Throw them in head, yeah. And then move the CSS from the head tag to the end of the body tag.
It doesn't
tag.
Block anything.
So yeah, because CSS blocks because you need CSS to load or else your page will look like crap.
Yep. Right.
Right. Yeah. So you save, and it's a lot to load our CSS. It's, you know, our main app.
Because we're not using purge CSS yet, which is still, the goal, but we don't, it's not a huge deal right now.
We have two CSS files, you know, we have add-ons that add CSS. Yep. We have all this, you know, there's just a lot. It's probably 100, if I had to guess, I'd say between 100 and 150 milliseconds.
Yep.
So shaving that off is
it's huge.
Pretty cool. It's like free.
Right. It's transparent.
Exactly.
It doesn't require anything. It's our problem, not their problem.
Right. Right.
That's so cool. So I just saved this as a watch later, but I haven't seen it yet. Adi Osmani was talking about, you know, the size of JS and all this kind of thing, saying like he was talking about a lot of these ideas, like shipping less stuff and making it faster. I like the architecture we're talking about solves so many problems, but we still have the uncanny valley. So that's kind of interesting to think about because like you could do all this stuff. And in some sense, it's almost like letting you punt on optimizing things and lowering, like dealing with like a JavaScript budget. Like we've never really worked on a site where we had like a budget that we stuck to for how much JavaScript we send. Whereas like performance critical sites, I've seen teams talk about that kind of thing. And so the idea here is like a lot of this, if you just accept the constraint that fastboots are going to generate your app at runtime, you can get away with way more, right? Because the initial response is fast and Lighthouse is going to be happy, with the one exception that if you go just take it to the logical conclusion, right? You have a fastboot generated page with inline 8 CSS. So the first render is like super fast, but you have like a 10 megabyte app or a 20 megabyte app.
Or take it to the extreme.
Yeah.
You have a gigabyte.
Right.
Gigabyte of JavaScript.
Right. So then they're going to be frustrated trying to click on links and things that don't work.
Yeah.
So that's just something. I don't know if there's any way around that other than just.
So I don't think there's
trade-offs here, right? It's trade-offs using less of a productive tool.
You know, my response to this, like for the apps that I work on, it's like, yeah, sure. There's 600 milliseconds where you can see the site and things like links work.
Right.
But forms don't work.
Right.
Or if you have like Ember components that are pop-ups,
right,
those won't work because the Ember app hasn't booted client side yet.
Right.
You know, again, like my response is that 600 milliseconds is perfectly okay.
Right.
I don't know. I mean,
I think if it's on like maybe... It would be interesting to like pick up some slower phones and try it out and see if you can recreate something realistic that's like 20 or 30 seconds. And it's like, okay, this is a problem.
Yeah. Definitely on older phones that you can notice.
Yep.
You can see when like fastboot rehydrates, like you can notice that.
I also think like we talked about this with John, where this is also, if this is a state of your application, just like going offline as a state, then you could code this and you could, you know, have some sort of indication of elements that don't work. You could have disabled form entries. And you could just say a loading thing like loading dot, 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 or something like that. So they're not frustrated the worst part of the uncanny valley is the idea that there's a UI element that has an affordance that's telling you I can click you or I can interact with you, and then it just doesn't work. That's what you want to avoid. So the next step up from that is not showing interactive elements that actually aren't interactive. And the next step up from that is like being super fast, I guess.
Yeah. I think you can get, intuitively, I think you can get so far. Like you can get so far by just showing everything. And then if someone tries to interact with it, you have some code, some small JavaScript that's, you know, loaded in line that says, okay, you're trying
to remember that.
Yeah. Remember it. Or like you're trying to interact with the interactive element and it's not yet activated.
Right.
And that when you press that button, instead of nothing happening, you can get some message,
right.
Some loading spinner, some something. And this is all we're talking here is initial render.
Right.
And then, you know, after that, everything, all the
normal
page navigations, everything is just instant.
Right.
So.
Right. And that's part of this too, which is like, sometimes lost in the discussions where there is an upfront cost and it does take a long time to load JavaScript. But once you're there, if you're in the app for a while, if you're moving around it, you're way faster than anything else. So, pretty interesting stuff. Yeah. I
want to like make a bet that this fast boot stuff is going to be way easier than all these like tools that do code splitting and all this stuff. Just getting a fast initial paint and then being interactive in, you know, 500, 600, even 1 second later.
That's going to be something that users are going to be perfectly happy with.
Basically. And it's going
to
be way easier.
It takes
them
more than a second or two to even become familiar with what they're looking at and want to know their next action.
And a developer, it's going to be way easier for you to manage that. And maybe
that's
there's a point where the tooling catches up and
code splitting is.
It's just, it works.
Right.
You don't ever have to think about it.
Also, like, there's probably big apps, you know, there's apps that are big enough that if you're stitching, you know, I know LinkedIn uses in repo engines. Let's say they have, you know, 16 in repo engines and they all get stitched together in a single build. There's no code splitting. Like you can imagine that being an issue, like basically entire products that are getting downloaded and used, but the user's never going to be even close to them. You can make the argument that like, that's going to slow things down and it's just going to slow things down. I mean, that could become the bottleneck, but for us, I think most of the time the bottleneck is there's other things that are the bottleneck. There's other things that are lower hanging fruit.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting what you're saying is like, that's the question is like, what's going to be easier and end up with the best user experience for the average developer with the average amount of resources and time and knowledge that they have. It would be interesting to talk to people who are doing code splitting outside of Ember with Ember. Yeah. And just see how that affects their work, you know?
I mean, I really might like code splitting.
And more than just someone who's like advertising on a website, like Webpack 4 does code splitting and it's so easy. Like I want to see have a conversation and understand how it actually affects their workflow, their development, what's hard about it, what's easy about it.
I guess the question is like, imagine two extremes. You have a server rendered Rails application that just spits out HTML, no JavaScript. On the other extreme, you have an Ember application that has no code splitting, no, just everything is one bundle. Mm-hmm. You download it, initialize it, and go. The code splitting, like a JavaScript build tool that does code splitting, seems way more closer to the Ember app than it does to the server side app.
Right.
Like when you're talking about improving performance, like even if you're code splitting, you still have to pay the JavaScript cost.
Right.
Smaller amount of JavaScript, but you still have to pay that cost.
Right.
So I think starting from the other extreme and building off of that.
Right.
Yeah.
Makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're just starting going down this journey, but
cool.
I feel okay about shipping.
Right. You don't feel
six
bad about
megabytes
it.
Of JavaScript because I know I can get a 90 on Lighthouse.
Right.
And that's
also the way you're getting 90 on Lighthouse is by installing an add-on or whatever. Like
eventually.
Yeah. The idea is like
so far from that, but yes,
but it's the idea that, you know, it's pretty cool that it's generalizable, you know?
Yeah.
What else have we been working on? I've been working on some Mirage stuff. We can talk about that maybe next week.
You're pretty excited.
I'm excited. Closing tons of bugs, getting it back up to a good space where we can add. There's a lot of things we've been talking about adding to make it easier to work with new tests, formats, using it in rendering tests, you know, all that kind of stuff. Getting the network inspector working with like running Mirage and a service worker, all sorts of cool stuff. We also have this idea about, you know, some people have kind of jerry-rigged their Mirage setup to be able to deploy an app to like S3 with Mirage and like demo it. And we've talked about wanting that to work on some features that like let people do that more easily. So that's like, that's kind of a more medium to long-term goal of ours.
So this idea, like it would work like Ember or CLI deploy, like you'd be able to.
Yeah. Like I think first to be able to install something that lets you, cause we've seen people set up just getting, their Ember apps with Mirage and like getting a URL to be able to preview it and, share it with someone. But, there's lots of ideas that we have around making like different scenarios easy to share or like, you know, and one thing we've talked about, and this is maybe something else that we were going to talk about today that we've just been talking a lot about in the last few weeks was like product process and how software teams actually build software and what features they work on and do they hit deadlines, all this stuff. And part of any product process is showing off your work. And Mirage is a great tool for that because it lets you iterate on the front end without having to write back end code, basically. And think through all the different states, loading states, you know, different user states very easily. So that helps show kind of the early stages of work. And so, yeah, the idea that there's like a service where people could publish their Ember apps with Mirage and basically get like a URL and see their apps running and like show different scenarios.
The showing different scenarios is... I mean, yeah, that makes my workflow so much easier.
Yeah.
Because, you know, every app I work on, it's always like, you know, I've said this before, but like, I know that user 123 is a user with like this sort of profile. Yes. And user 456 is a user that, you know, has this different profile. And you just like, remember, you like memorize all these IDs and it's like, oh, let me get this situation.
Right.
And, you know, and then your development environment can never be changed.
Right.
Because if you ever change it, you throw out like months of...
Well, this is what we've talked about before too, with like the way staging environments get used at companies on teams, they become second production environments.
Yeah.
So, 100%. You know, just talking about trying to get to a place where it's easy to preview changes or test changes in many different scenarios. It's not as easy as it could be right now. So that'd be something I'd be interested to hear from folks on as well. I mean, we even like to set up some calls with people. So I think we'll probably be reaching out to some people. But just if you're a developer on a team right now and you're working with like a product manager or a stakeholder or other developers and, you know, you get a ticket assigned to you and you work on it and you're done. So you're done to the point where you want to show the work and you don't sit right next to it. So I guess the question would be, how do you show that work?
Yeah. Or like, let's say you have a question, like something came up and you realize there's a new state, there's like an error state. How do you show that? How
right.
do you say like, what should happen here?
Right. So do you just say, come, you know, you raise your hand and you have your product person come over. Do you tell them to like git pull the repo, which maybe works if they're a developer, you know, and we've done that too. Like we work with people on consulting projects and we want to see their changes. And for us, sometimes the easiest thing is just git pull.
Yep.
And there's a couple of different scenarios in Mirage, or you run the test suite. Like, do you run the test suite? Test suites do a good job of documenting like what you're working on, but is there an easy way to preview that? I know there was that cool add-on that had that idea of like running a story.
Yep. Telling stories, I think was the name.
But like, I think ideally you have like this thing running in a browser and you can just like, and you could even show like, here's everything I worked on and here are the four different situations that you should go through to check if this is what you were expecting the thing to do, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that. Do you call them and do a screen share? So I'd actually like just to put that question out to our listeners, if anyone could answer, you know, on Twitter or in our Ember Map room on the Slack, the community Slack. Like, when you are done with a feature, how do you show it to someone? Do you show it to someone? Do you merge it in and give them a staging link? Do you wait until it's in production? And how do you show them?
Yeah.
So. Because that's been on our minds a lot. And I think there's a future where Mirage can really help there too.
Yep.
So.
Cool. I'm excited to hear what people say.
Yeah, me too. Definitely. So yeah, that's kind of some of the house cleaning work that I've been doing in Mirage is all because, you know, of all these things that we want to get done. So, and then, what else have we been working on? I feel like there's a couple other things we've been working on.
Fast food testing.
Oh yeah, right. So this is also, yes, the Mirage stuff. I think we might have talked about this on one of the podcasts, but you have your Mirage, you have your fast boot testing.
Yeah, stuff. We talked about the Mirage fast boot
and then stuff. The Mirage fast boot stuff we talked about. Yeah. But so let's talk about that.
Yeah, I have an add-on. It is published, but it's one of those 0.0.0. So you totally know you can trust that API won't change.
0.0.0.1.
No, 0.0.0. So the idea is like Fastboot, it's really easy to break Fastboot. Fastboot runs in this thing called Simple DOM, and it is this lightweight implementation of the DOM, but it's not spec compliant with a browser's DOM. And the reason for this is that Fastboot needs to run on the server, and it needs to generate a response fairly quickly. And it doesn't need like event listeners because it just needs to get that HTML string and send it down to the client.
Mm-hmm.
So Simple DOM is this like half implementation of a DOM. It's basically an implementation of a DOM that's needed to render an Ember app in Fastboot. That's like the reason why this thing exists.
So you mean Ember? Like literally it was
written for Ember. Yes,
it was written. Who wrote it?
Core team.
Okay.
So cool. Yeah. So there's a trade-off here that it needs to be fast and it doesn't need to be spec compliant, but that means it's possible to write code that won't run in Simple DOM. The Simple DOM just doesn't know how to execute.
Okay.
So you can't reference document, you can't reference window. Okay. It doesn't know about these things. It doesn't care about these things.
Time out. The idea for it being a slim version and being fast was because Fastboot needed to be fast, but given the constraints we were talking about, that no longer really applies in the case of architecture that we're using.
Maybe you could use JS DOM, which is like I think JS DOM is a full.
It's
DOM.
More like a popular.
I think it's a spec compliant.
Okay.
DOM implementation okay. in Node. Maybe, but there could be something else here, like maybe JS DOM takes a lot of memory.
Okay.
Or maybe there's like. Yeah, maybe.
Okay, it's just made for other things. This is like made specifically for like fast booting Ember apps.
For rendering an Ember app on the server.
Yeah.
Okay. It gives you can think of it as an implementation of the DOM that gives you just enough APIs to render something on the server.
Okay.
And because of this, maybe in retrospect it should have been a fuller implementation
because
it would reduce some bugs with the trade-off of being slower.
Right.
But that's okay. Because we've already acknowledged that Fastboot is too slow to run at runtime anyway.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. Resume.
Because of this, no window, no document.
Mm-hmm.
But it also, when it's rendering your Ember application, it doesn't execute like did insert element. It doesn't execute those hooks in your component. And generally, like that's where you add your event listeners is in did insert element.
Mm-hmm.
So the only like, if you have code that references window.addEventListener in didInsertElement, you don't have to worry because it's not going to run didInsertElement when it's generating your HTML. But if you put window or document anywhere else,
it blows up.
It blows up. Mm-hmm. It fails with an error. Like cannot you've referenced document, you're not allowed to reference document inside of Fastboot. And it's pretty easy to put these references all over the place. Like we have a component that references window inside of did receive adders, and it needs to know if it's like this component needs to know if it's getting these attributes as like a re-render or a fresh render, and it changes I think like does like a transition end. It attaches a transition end onto like its existing element.
Okay.
Because it does some animation stuff.
I see.
And then when it's an initial render, you don't want to animate. You just want to put it right in this state.
Right, right, right.
Another example is like initializers in Ember apps. I think we have an initializer that adds some keyboard events that to do like the outline. It outlines A elements when you tab through them. but if you click on them, it doesn't. And we set all that up inside of an initializer. So that, and we do that by, you know, event listeners on window. So there's all these places you can access the stuff and break fastboot. And when you're developing your Ember app locally, it's so hard to know this because if, first of all,
you're not thinking about it.
You're not thinking about it. A lot of us have been working on the same Ember app before fastboot came out.
Right.
So we were, this was never even a concern,
right,
you know, 4 years ago. Fastboot is only for initial render. So if you render a page and then you start clicking around, like as you click around and render new components, you're not rendering those components in fastboot.
Right.
So even if you're developing in a fastboot environment, you know, if you're doing stuff after render, you're not going to, you're not going to see it. You're not going to know that this component won't work in fastboot because it's not running in fastboot now. So there's so many ways to break fastboot. And we have a great testing story in Ember. I mean, I'm so confident that my Ember apps work because of my acceptance tests.
Right.
Because I can visit all these pages, click all these things, and just assert that the page looks a certain way. And so the idea with this add-on that I'm working on is that you can write acceptance tests that get run against a fastboot generated response. So that's pretty, it's pretty mind-blowing.
So, okay. So walk us through how that.
Yeah. So you're talking about like peel back the covers.
Yeah.
So there, one of my favorite APIs from Ember testing is visit. So you say, you know, await visit slash about, and that renders the about page. And so I have the same thing. I have a fastboot test. There's a folder in your test folder called fastboot tests, and you import visit from fastboot tests. And that visit works similar to the visit that we're all familiar with, except instead of like telling the client to render the app, it goes to the server and says, hey, I need the HTML for this page. So if I say visit post slash one, it will send an AJAX request to your test server and say, hey, in a spin up a fastboot instance and generate the HTML for post slash one. And it does that. It sends the response back as a fastboot object that contains a whole bunch of things about what fastboot just did.
And including the HTML that was generated.
Including the HTML that was generated. And then this visit helper then takes that HTML that was generated and shoves it into that little, testing container.
Okay.
That little
Ember testing container.
Yeah, the Ember testing
container. That's usually rendering your app on the client.
That's usually rendering your app on the client. And then you can see, now that you have the HTML rendered in that div, you can now use things like the QNIT DOM, which is awesome testing API. So you can say, like, QNIT DOM gives you an API where you can say,
assert H1 about or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Assert there's an H1 on this page and it has this text, the text that says about. And so at that point, it's just the same.
From the developer's perspective.
Same testing story.
Wow. So, okay, that sounds amazing. What's the testing story right now? What are people doing right now with the fastboot apps?
So, everything.
Because it sounds like a ton of work.
Everything from nothing at all.
Uh-huh.
So on Ember Map right now, other than when I'm playing with this add-on, we do not test anything in fastboot. So it's all, the testing story is all as I'm developing, I'm reloading the page and making sure things aren't broken.
I see.
All the way to like in our add-ons, we have Node Mocha tests that like import fastboot, and they're familiar with all the fastboot APIs. So they like import fastboot, set up a new fastboot server, generate that HTML, and then we use Simple DOM to render. I'm making air quotes for our listeners. We render that HTML in Node. We give that, and the way we do that is with JS DOM. So we give that HTML that was generated from fastboot to JS DOM. JS DOM gives us a DOM API for this HTML. So then we can do things like document.querySelector, some test ID, dot text dot trim to make sure that test ID has the right text rendered inside of it. This is a ton of setup work.
Ton of setup.
We do this in Storefront. So if you go look at Storefront, has a folder in the root called fastboot tests that do this. And you can if you're familiar with Ember's testing, or you're familiar with like testing in Mocha, you'll be able to understand what's going on here.
And so getting Fastboot to actually render at test time, that's all coming from like the Fastboot add-on, and that's all there. You just have to wire it all up.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fastboot has a super small API surface area, so it is easy to use Fastboot.
Do you like new it up?
Yeah.
And, okay.
Yeah. You new it up, and Fastboot's basically Fastboot's only API is .visit.
Okay.
And that's visit takes a URL and it renders that. And there's some other things here, but
so with your add-on, basically the idea is, so Ember Map is a Fastboot Ember app. We install, what's it, your add-on called? Fastboot test or something?
Something like that. Yeah. Ember, we'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah. So I install Fastboot tests, and then I create like Fastboot test folder, and then I do my setup hooks or whatever, and that just lets me do visit. But like that's going to send an Ajax request. It's going to spin up a Fastboot instance of the app with all. Now, is this like an isolated app or it's a full application? And like
it takes a last build. It takes a last broccoli build.
Okay.
Of your application, because you have when you're running tests, you're building the application. Because if like you change a file, the application rebuilds.
I see. So reloads. When you're running Ember test, all the acceptance tests are using the same build of your Ember app.
Yep.
And like rendering tests are using like snippets of things, like that's separate. But the actual app that's being run, because I imagine you can't do something like a rendering test in Fastboot.
Correct.
Fastboot needs an Ember app. Ember app.
Fastboot's API is visit. It takes a URL and returns some HTML.
Right.
And again, I'm glossing over some stuff, but just think of
that. At a high level, new Fastboot, and you pass in an Ember app or a definition of an Ember app, something like this.
Right.
Okay, so...
Right, so you can't like... Another way to say this is with a current Fastboot, you can't like Fastboot a component.
Right.
That doesn't make sense.
Right.
So you like Fastboot an app and then you visit URLs.
Yep. Okay, that makes sense. So then it takes the test build. You have an Ember app built with an environment of a build environment of test.
Yep.
And it loads that up into Fastboot, and then you can call visit on it and it spits back the HTML and the status and everything.
Yep.
And that all happens within Ember CLI.
Yep.
And so that means it'll run on like CI as well. Well, it does right now when we do it in storefront. I think we do it in Tailwind too. And that's so cool. And then, so not only does it set all that up, your add-on, it also takes the string and puts it in that testing container, which gives you that nice API for asserting against it. Yeah. You're not working with like an object in JavaScript. You're just, you actually see it.
Well, one of the coolest things when I was doing this and I got it working is I would visit some page and then await pause test. And it's all the CUNA APIs are hooked up. So you just pause test and
There's your
Fastboot response in your testing container.
That's right. And I remember looking over and watching you see this, because when you're working on this, you know, what normally happens when you get a Fastboot response is you see the initial render and then Ember initializes and takes over. And so you were working on getting it to the point where you can say freeze at the Fastboot render.
Yep.
So let's say you could Fastboot render a bug, but then like by the time Ember takes over, it's fine. And it's so fast, like you're not understanding this intermediate state. Of course, with these tests, you want it to be deterministic. You want to be able to say, show me what Fastboot sent.
Yeah, you only get that Fastboot state.
Okay.
You don't get the Ember app does not take over. In fact, we don't even render the script tags, because the script tags are like for a full Ember app and we're in the testing app. So we only render the Fastboot body.
Right.
And this is, you know, like I said, the add-on 0.0.0.
Right.
These are where some APIs will probably change. It's like, how much do we render?
Right.
Right now we're only rendering like the body response. There's a thing in Fastboot, like body start and body end.
I see.
And we're rendering that, which is basically, you can think of that as your application template.
I see. Right. So if your app is doing a bunch of stuff with like head or whatever.
So there is an API, because most people that are Fastbooting apps are doing stuff in head with meta tags for like search bots and stuff like that. So there is an API where you can get CUNET DOM assertions against your head tag.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So like for our case, when we first used Fastboot, it was to get meta OG media tags.
Exactly.
So now we can actually write a test that says.
Yeah. And that
it's only taken a year. Yeah. It's like actual critical functionality though, in a sense, like if you were working at TED, you'd want share tags to work and you'd want them to be tested.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why this head API exists.
I see.
Because I know that one of the first tests we're going to write for Ember Map is that, you know, like, do my, do my share tag show up correctly?
Right.
And that's super important. That's why we're using Fastboot.
That's awesome. And so once we get Mirage working, you can write a test that says, server, create me a video with this slug description and title. Visit this and assert the Fastboot head contains the OG tag with the description. Right?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So this, I mean, the...
That's amazing.
The Mirage stuff is this is stuff I haven't thought about, and it's like purposely haven't thought about. I've put up a wall in my head. But it's like we're booting your Fastboot app on the server.
Yeah.
So if you run like a server create on the client, we need to like communicate to the server. Like when you think about it, like you're writing acceptance test in it. Oh. Your Fastboot test, it does like server.create. And then it tells Fastboot to like render.
Oh, because your test is running in the client.
Yeah, your test is.
So the visit helper that your thing is gonna, your add-on is gonna include, provide, makes a network request.
Yes.
Oh.
Because we need Node to generate the response. Right. So yeah. Now you as a developer writing these tests, you don't know that it makes. I mean, right. You can peel back the layers.
It's just an Ajax. It's just an asynchronous thing. Okay, that's very interesting. So. Now you're going to have to await server create or something like that.
There's something render the post/slash one page and also just know that I've created these Mirage models that you should be aware of when you're rendering this. So
very interesting.
Lucky for me, I sit next to the guy that wrote Mirage. So.
Oh, this is so interesting. Okay, now I have to start thinking about this because...
I think this idea that, so first of all, visit.
I mean, if you let your Fastboot app make a request and you just have Mirage running in Express.
Yeah, that work totally works.
I'm trying to think how you could make it so that you don't have to await a server create. Because that would suck. Because, like, you shouldn't have to await async. You want to say given a you know, an instance of the Ember map application running with this database. Await is kind of like too implementation detail-y for that thing. Await visit makes sense because...
Let's remove Fastboot from this this equation. If Mirage is running on the server and inside of an acceptance test, I do await
server create
user, or I do server create user, that information is going to have to go back to the server so that the server knows that this user was just created. Yes. So I think you're going to have to
Have to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or since you await visit, and visit could just not run until all the creates have happened.
Right. Visit could,
but that's sneaky.
Yeah.
That is sneaky. You want
you want
to push that API onto the user.
Yeah, it might make sense actually.
Await's
not bad. It's more just like the tests are really good when it's just, you know, given this world when I click and wait, and like the await I don't mind as part of the acting part of the test, because if you're talking to a user like click here and you're waiting for something and like then you do this, those are all sync, right? It's kind of maps to like how the user is using the app.
Yeah, you know, though, I think if you were writing in Node and you were like inserting data into an SQL database for testing, all these Node libraries are all async.
That's true.
So there would be await user.create.
Right.
Because that is
right. That's true. So. That's true.
You know, it's fine. I've been writing a lot of Node for all this.
Yep.
And that the async await makes Node so much easier. And the fact that like actually Node libraries are like adopting promises and there's no more of this, even though under the hood, everything is just like callback error, comma results.
Yep. You just don't care about that stuff there's anymore.
There's enough promise support that you don't have to worry about that stuff. Await. It's to the point, though, where it's like everything is a wait. Like, you're doing so much that you do start to throw a wait in front of everything.
Yeah.
And you can't chain a wait. So, wait doesn't work with chain. So, if, like, you do, like, X, call, like, X, open parens, close parens, dot Y, open parens, close parens, dot Z, open parens, close parens.
Yep.
And those are all async. Like you have to do each of those individually, or like wrap each one of those in a wait.
Mm-hmm. So kind of a bummer.
Yeah, it leaks. Like me as a developer, I have to know that every single part of the code I'm calling, what's async and what's not. Where I can't just say await x.y.c. and let those things figure it out. And it makes, I mean, it makes sense why that is.
Yeah, yeah. No, the chaining API is really nice. I was thinking about this because we were just talking about, I think this was like, I think you messaged on Slack about this when you were doing this coding, because you were like, JavaScript's interesting. It has like this OO stuff, but you can't send a message anywhere the way you can in Ruby. It has this functional stuff, but you can't define like operations on myself. You're dealing with the enumerable thing. And so you're in this kind of in-between world.
Yeah, I think this is just, yeah, there's so much that's been bolted on to,
right,
to JS. We were trying to make an enumerable object, and we did like class X extends array,
right?
But that doesn't work because you can't use map on
class. It's not really a subclass of array, yeah, the way you would expect.
Right.
Well, I was going to ask is like in Ruby. So the chain, I was thinking like, yeah, JavaScript is weird, it's this hybrid thing, but it's part of why it's successful too. Like it has great patterns from OOP, but you can also pass around functions as first class. But it's easy to do it. Like it's very natural.
I mean, that's not that. I'll push back. I'll say that's not why JavaScript's successful.
Well,
JavaScript's successful because it runs in the browser.
Yeah.
Runs on every computer.
Sure. I think JavaScript, the language, is pretty accessible.
Yeah. Yeah. Ruby's easier. Ruby's way easier. I think you can teach. I think you... There are folks out there who would be like, functional programming is the best way to teach programming. But yeah, functional programming is way too... Functional programming is like
it's basic, what they're saying makes hard. Sense for a certain in a certain way,
right?
But what we're talking about is kind of like,
so I think Ruby gives you enough magic that
you can do like function add xy. I mean, the function cool thing, add like without making a class in Ruby.
Say like I don't follow.
For me, like in JavaScript, like function add x comma y return x plus y is a great.
Oh yeah, you can do it. You can create you can create lambdas, and that's not a pattern that you see often in Ruby. But yes, you can. Most folks classes for everything.
Right.
Also, like that function add xy in JavaScript, that's going to be like in the global namespace now. Where in Ruby, you would say like function add xy would be a local variable.
Right.
It would be like stabby proc.
Right.
Add xy, and that's a local variable called add. So you do lose. That is a good point. That's like accessibility that you would lose in Ruby.
Right.
Now, of course, you could put that on like the object.
Which is
a global thing.
But yeah. That's not how you would teach Ruby. Whereas when you're teaching JavaScript, that's literally what you would. I've done this before. You open up a console, and that's what you do.
Function console. Yep.
So there's something there. But I was just thinking about this as we were talking about this, because like, what else do you get from this weird hybrid model, multimodal programming language thing? Like chaining APIs are awesome. Like D3, jQuery, promises even, like chaining APIs.
Yeah.
Like that's not, do you do that in Ruby a lot?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yes. I'm trying to think like, do you do that in like functional languages? Functional languages, like you chain the APIs, but you do that by composing.
You chain
through composition.
Elixir, like, and pipe.
Exactly. Right. But like even just step back from like the, you're like, you create a single function by composing a bunch of functions together, and that looks like a chain.
Right.
And then you execute that single function, where with like Ruby, it would be, you're chaining. Ruby's more like JavaScript, where you're chaining like returns.
Right.
Things return, you chain onto them.
So there's something nice. It's almost, I might be stepping out of my knowledge zone here, but you know, the railway pattern or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Where you can like exit.
Exactly. Promises got us some aspects of that in JavaScript.
Oh,
that is.
Yeah. 100%.
So there's something nice about that, cause you can keep chaining and then you like catch at the end, but like the API paper is over that. So do we lose that with the awaits kind of, I mean that the ergonomics of that?
No,
I get it. Desugar is the same thing, but I'm saying going back to what you were saying, where you could do methods and there's something nice that there's a bit of abstraction there. Whereas now, await.
So the railroad pattern thing, it would be like try a bunch of awaits, catch, which I don't do.
Right.
I mean, I probably should.
It's easier to do dot catch at the end, isn't it? Then
yes.
Yeah.
100%.
That's kind of like.
Yeah, because when I do the try, it's like, what's my scope?
Yeah.
What's going on here? Like, the await stuff is, it's easier. It's way easier than callbacks.
Yeah.
It's way easier than promises, even though it's just sugar for promises, it's still easier. But yeah, there's something about all those. It's like the intermediate awaits.
Right.
Because you would like let X equal await function call X, let Y equal await X function call Y.
Right.
Let, and it's like, why am I making this variable called Y?
Right. Like, right. So. Interesting. All right. Well, we should probably wrap it up. We got into one of our tangents here, yeah. But no, all that to say, the node stuff, it's so much better. Also, I'm happy about that because, you know, I was working on the new API for Mirage that lets you give it like a server and like handle response or handle request. And that's what's going to let Mirage run in node. It's going to be what lets Mirage run in node, which is going to enable a bunch of stuff we've been talking about.
Nice.
So, that means like, for Mirage to run a node, like we're in this awesome world now where all the classes that are in Mirage, we can use Babel. Actually, we're using ESM to turn those like ES6 class modules, which most of Mirage is built in ES6 classes, into common JS modules so it can run a node. But like just knowing that all my code is going to work everywhere and I can use class and constructor and super and all that stuff. Whereas like the node code I wrote a couple of years ago was like that prototype, that all this stuff is just bananas.
It's so much better.
So that makes me really excited for that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, complain about JavaScript all the time, but it's also the language I use every day.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Yeah.
It's way better.
It's gotten so much better. It's gotten so much better.
And you can also see it. The future is going to be even better than it's right now. Like that's a bet that I would take today. Like JavaScript in 5 years from now is going to be like way better than it is now.
Yes.
And we can see just like all like the decorator stuff people are doing, the like call operator that's getting a lot of attention, just all that stuff is going to make all these APIs easier. And that, hey, speaking of that, complaining about awaits, that call API might be like the answer for this, where it's like you get to chain these things.
Right.
So maybe.
Cool.
All right,
let's wrap it. Thanks for listening. Please do let us know about the question we had. So
how do you share your work?
How do you share your work today? Really curious about that. Let us know on Twitter, on Slack. Thanks for listening. And hopefully our voices sound better this time. And we'll continue to sound better, silky smooth. Maybe we could become like jazz singers, you know?
Yeah.
Long shot?
Let's not quit our day jobs just yet.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.